Well, good morning, everybody. It's lovely to be here. I am Tim. Yes, thank you. Glad some people know who I am. One of the things I miss most on holidays is going to church. Where we go down the coast is about 40 minutes from church, and I would have to say probably on a Sunday it would be very rare for us to darken the door of a church down there. But it is wonderful to come back into community and to sing and to share together this morning. So that's just, you know, that's the thing I noticed immediately when wandering in. I would reckon that Ecclesiastes is probably the most existential of the books in the Bible, potentially the most philosophical and sometimes the hardest to understand. But I'll pray and let's see how we go. Dear God, we thank you for your great and unbounded love for us. Help us to understand your mind more clearly so that we might serve you more readily. Amen. A new year, new you. You're going to die, so you might as well live. A common destiny for all. I wasn't sure what to call today's sermon. It outlines a couple of things about death and a couple of things about life. We see death's inevitability writ throughout the passage, and yet God's sovereignty. We see death's reality, particularly in verses 2 and 3. There is a contrast between the lost and the saved, and yet we all still will die. We understand life's brevity, and we're instructed to live with a committed purpose, to live with enthusiastic passion. And the passage finishes with life's uncertainty, that time and chance happen to us all. Ecclesiastes is written by somebody identified as the teacher, and it records his mission to find out what it takes to live well in this topsy-turvy world. And the conclusion is that living well involves a life shaped by the Lord. But to get to that point, the teacher takes us on a mission of discovery. It's a mission of discovery that gets us to the point where we can understand and perhaps assent to his final conclusion. And to do that, we need to read this somewhat strange book. And we need to feel the confusion and the pain and the uncertainty. We need to be faced with the harsh reality that the teacher observes and the surprising truths. And this is what the book of Ecclesiastes invites us to do. It sets up this picture for us that in a beautiful world that's been made and given to us by God, we find ourselves stressed and worried because we often try to be God rather than to worship God. We try to control the world around us all the time as we're trying to know and control our future. And this is at odds with trusting in a good God who's in control over all things, as opposed to all of us, who of course are not even in control of ourselves some of the time. So as we read through Ecclesiastes, what we will have noticed is that this book has reflections on daily life. But it also has thoughts that rise above, that transcend and then look down on daily life. And today's passage looks at the topic of life and death, looks at the topics of living and work, and it looks at it from three different altitudes, if you like. And the higher we go, the more we see. There's the ground level day-to-day picture, and then there's the hot air balloon picture, and then there's the view from space picture. And hopefully we're going to have a chance to look at all three of those views, mindful of the fact that we have to live in the day-to-day. Ecclesiastes keeps coming back to its key themes: life and death, work, wealth, justice, authority, meaning. And as we move through the book, it keeps circling back to its key topics. It's built or based around a key concept, though. Hebel, or Hebel, depending on how you want to pronounce it. That which is meaningless. That which is mist and vapor. Or as Lee put it, smoke. All we do and all we have in our current experience of life is mist and vapor. It doesn't last. It's hard to hold on to. And that's the problem. And it's an especially significant problem when it comes to work. Now, if we were to jump back to chapter 2, we'd see that the teacher has been a worker. Not that he's been a bum who's done no work and had no experience of it and then decries it. Part of his project in chapter 2 was to engage in work as much as he could do. He built things, he grew things, he made money, he established status. But his conclusion from chapter 2, after he'd achieved everything, was that he hated life. Because the work that was done under the sun was grievous to him. All of it was a mist or a vapor, a chasing after the wind. He hated all the things he toiled for under the sun because they were going to be left to somebody who came after him. Which is not necessarily a problem. It's not saying, hey, don't leave an inheritance. But the problem was whether the one who was going to come afterwards was going to be wise or foolish. And yet, regardless of the wisdom or foolishness of those who came after, all of the fruit of his labor would be under the control of somebody else. All of his toil would go into somebody else's hand. And so he saw that in some senses, his work was meaningless. We jump back into chapter 9. Chapter 9 says, anyone who is among the living has hope. Hooray! That's a positive, isn't it? In an otherwise not necessarily cheery passage. Even a live dog is better off than a dead lion. I don't know if anybody came to church this morning to be called a live dog. Well, guess what? You've just been called a... No, I'm not saying that. But the passage says it. It says that all share a common destiny, the righteous and the wicked, the good and the bad. And this is not a good thing. This is the evil that happens under the sun. The same destiny overtakes us all. We all die. So what are we to do? Well, verse 7 to 10 give us a picture of what our response might be to this existential problem. Now, on the ground level, there's a realization that often in life we work and we work really hard. We tell ourselves that life and work have a greater purpose, that life and our use of it, the life and our pursuits will make us happy when we have accomplished what we set out to. When we've got hold of what we're after. But at the most basic level, the writer of Ecclesiastes poses the question, does our pursuit of these things have any grand meaning? What's the point? What's our point? Is there a point? And I reckon that's an unsettling question. And I suspect that you, like me, have wrestled with it at some point in time in your life. Is there something in life that's going to bring us joy? Is this the thing that will bring me joy? What are we doing? Why are we putting all our energy into this thing that we think's going to last when it's not going to last? These are the questions, I think. And I think Ecclesiastes is more a book of questions than a book of answers. But these are the sorts of questions that Ecclesiastes puts up for us to ponder. And then says, it's all hebel. It's all mist and vapor. Things don't last. Life is transitory. Life is fleeting. It's hard and perhaps it's not what we think it might be. But maybe you're like me, thinking, I actually really like my life. I like my job. I like what I do on my day to day. And if that's you, great. Because the teacher in Ecclesiastes would celebrate with you. He would celebrate the fact that you like what you do for a job day to day. But he'd also want you to know that it won't necessarily last. And he would want you to confirm that you are loving your work, but you're not banking your life on your work. And I wonder if this is why Jesus says, do not store up for yourself treasures on earth where rust and moths can destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But he says, store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where rust and moths do not destroy, where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, your heart will be also. Is there a difference between working hard and storing up treasure? Yeah, I think there is. The teacher notes that work is good, but not when it becomes the heart and the meaning, the making meaning of our lives. And this, I think, is the ground level view of the passage today. Don't make work your meaning-making thing. Let's move to a different perspective. Let's go up a level, the hot air balloon perspective. To do that, we jump back a bit to chapter 6. Because there's a frustration with work, and the frustration with work is that we seem to be unable to enjoy what we have, and that affects our attitude to work and wealth. And it's less about our daily grind in our daily working lives and more to do with our hearts. So if we go up a level, we're moving away from the day-to-day and we're moving to our motivation, what guides us, what leads us to act as we act. The teacher observes that there's nothing worse in life than being unable to enjoy what God has given you. Why? Why is there nothing worse than being unable to enjoy what God's given you? Because it leads to a life of frustrated living, where we seek after this enjoyment, where we seek after that fulfillment, where we seek after the fleeting things and they keep going and getting further and further away from us. We run after the smoke and the mist, and it disappears. We chase the dawn and it runs away. It leads to not more fulfillment, not more enjoyment, but greater and greater frustration. So the point of Ecclesiastes is to say, stop chasing. The point of Ecclesiastes is to lead us or guide us into beautiful living, wise living, not frustrated living. There is a striving that drives all of us, I suspect, and it can lead us to thinking that our work is never good enough. Our life is never good enough. We are never good enough. Our recognition isn't significant enough. Our income isn't big enough. I don't know what it is for you, but I think if we seek to find meaning in who we are and what we do, we will come up short, that we ourselves will be found wanting, and this will frustrate us. And in chapter 6, verse 3, there's a really, really alarming comment. A comment that says that a stillborn child is better off than a person who cannot enjoy their prosperity and receive a proper burial. Wow. It says this, it comes out without meaning, it departs in darkness, and in darkness its name is shrouded. That's shocking, isn't it? Shocking for a purpose. I wouldn't want to minimize the pain and the devastation of the loss of a child, particularly a child before its time, which in itself is a reminder of the brokenness of the world. But it's stunning, isn't it, that it says how vacuous a life is without contentment, without peace, without joy. Such a life could last for 2,000 years, but it would be more futile than that of a stillborn child, if a person cannot learn to see the good in life. Is it a possibility that the comment about not receiving a proper burial might indicate that the person was somehow distant or estranged from all of those who were that person's descendants because they were too caught up in their own life and their own work and they destroyed and broke the relationships that they lived along the way? Don't know. It's interesting how breathtakingly stupid sin is. And it's more its breathtaking stupidity that's apparent, I think, to the writer of Ecclesiastes. Think about this. We go on hoarding goods to our own harm, even though the goods bring us a lack of satisfaction, bring us worry, bring us sleeplessness, bring us frustration, bring us anger. The issue at hand is not about what we have or don't have, but why it is we can't be thankful for what we have. I think there is for all of us, and I find myself, you know, if I daydream, sometimes I find myself daydreaming this little loop, that if my circumstances changed, then life would somehow be better, that if this was different, then life would be better. And you know what? Circumstances do change, don't they? But life isn't better just because of the changed circumstances. It isn't a matter of what we have. It isn't a matter of what we can get. It's a matter of what we are grateful for. If we get sucked into believing that gain will bring us satisfaction, we end up in a never-ending cycle of pursuit of gain without remembering to enjoy the things that we sought in the first place. There's no doubt that there are good things in this life to be thankful for, and we ought to be, and we ought to look forward to them. But guess what? Sometimes we miss the beauty of the things that we have, of the moment that we're in, of the season, of the people, of the food, of the festivities, because we're waiting for what's next, for what's better. One of the funniest reminders for me of this was one time, and my brother's in Australia at the moment, which is delightful. I've been really enjoying that. He lives in America. I see him every couple of years, and I really love seeing him. I remember one time playing cricket with my boys and with him in the front yard, and he missed the catch because he was busy filming the shot. And I think sometimes we're like that in life. Oh, I've got to capture this. I've got to get this down. Mate, put your phone down and play cricket. Let's make sure that we put our phones down and metaphorically play cricket. Because if we're always looking for what's next or what's better, that sets us up for dissatisfaction. A profound dissatisfaction for the present, for the moment that we're in. So why is it sometimes that we can't be thankful for what we have and for where we are? So what the teacher is urging us is to reorient, not necessarily our jobs, but our hearts, not necessarily our circumstances, but our approach. We need to be more present. We need to be more able to take simple joys in a job well done, and less worried, more joyful, more loving. God notices us at work. He gives us the opportunity for joy and satisfaction in it. It's there. It's available. So on the ground level, we go to work. It's good, sometimes frustrating. It can give us a pause to think. What are we doing? Why are we doing it? And this is when we need to go up that level, the hot air balloon level, which gives us a bigger picture, where we need to think about what's in our hearts and whether we're enjoying the things that God has given us. And then we need to go up again to get the biggest picture, looking down from spaces, if you like, to realize that there is a bigger picture as seen in chapter 9. Think about this. We are alive in a world that's full of evil and madness, and all of us will face death at some point in time, some sooner than others. But we are alive, and that's something. We're alive, and in fact, being alive is better than being dead. And of course, life won't last forever. We won't live forever. But we're alive now, and life is a gift for living, so live it. And the teacher lists four things from verses 7 through to 10 that might serve to fire our imagination for living. Hooray. First of all, he says, go eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart. For God has already approved what you do. All right. How good is that? I don't know what you plan to do for lunch today, but make it good. I don't know what you plan to do for dinner. Have some nice wine with it. One of the great joys of having my brother, who's the youngest of the four of us, out is that he gets away with stuff that the others of us don't. And my mum and dad celebrated their 50th wedding anniversary yesterday, so very exciting, in our house. And we were all down the coast to do that. And my brother, of course, was able to raid the cellar at mum and dad's and take all the good stuff down the coast with him. It was fantastic. My old man was a teacher for 50 years, and he got given quite a number of bottles over the years that were pretty good. So over the last 3 or 4 days, I think the youngest wine I drank was maybe 25 years old. And none of them were corked! So, as you can understand, as I was preparing the sermon, I was thinking, yes, how true is this? Eat your food with gladness and drink your wine with a joyful heart. What was even better is that Sarah was cooking most of the meals, so they were good. So get stuck into being alive. We've been given the gift of life. We ought to be thankful for it. And this thankfulness should be seen in how we respond to what we have. But the question is that at odds with Ecclesiastes 3 and the seasons of life, including a time for mourning and a time for dancing? Then in verse 8 it says, always be clothed in white and with a head anointed with oil. This is the dress and the garment of joy, not mourning. It's not the black and sackcloth and ashes of mourning. The teacher is saying we need perhaps to be willing to celebrate the life that God has given us, even with its ups and downs. The third thing that he says is to enjoy life with your wife, whom you love, all the days of this fleeting life that God has given us under the sun. You might be married, you might not. It's easy, it's all too easy, I think, to forget the blessings of a partner, of friends, of family. But instead of forgetting the blessings, we need to be present in our relationships. We need to enjoy and appreciate them again through the ups and downs. And then finally it says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. You could be forgiven for thinking that if everything is a mist, smoke, fleeting, chabel, meaningless, then work is a waste of time. But no, this is not what the teacher says. This is not the conclusion the teacher draws. He says that it's a worthy goal to invest energy in our work, bearing in mind that our work comes from the hand of God. We're given four things here. Think about it in the verses we've just looked at. Thankfulness, joy, valuing relationships, and working well. So thankfulness, joy, valuing relationships, and working well. And funnily enough, when you put these four things together, it looks like a picture of the kingdom of God. The kingdom of the New Testament that's given to us through Jesus, who says, seek first the kingdom, and who also invited us to store up treasures in heaven. Kingdom treasures, where there is no chabel, where things last. He says that where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. We're all going to die, so we all ought to live. So a quick recap of our look at Ecclesiastes from the three different perspectives. From the ground level, yes, we're working hard, nothing lasts forever. If we're honest with ourselves, that's sometimes unsettling. You'll know the feeling if you've ever got a new job or a promotion or bought a new car or a new computer or a camera or a surfboard or whatever it is. It's fantastic and then it isn't. We become inured of it or to it and it wears out. It breaks. It doesn't satisfy us as we thought, or somebody else has a better one. So we need some perspective. We need to lift our sights. And we need to realize that perhaps the issue is not just with the particular job or particular thing, but rather that we're struggling to enjoy what God has given us. And that we're always dissatisfied. And this is going to flow into our work, our view of wealth and stuff, our view of relationships, other things, the very stuff of life. So we need another outlook still. So we climb again to the space level and we look down with the biggest perspective of the lot. And we're reminded as we sit here sharing time together that we are all alive and that alive is better than dead, and this life of ours has been given to us by a good God. And so we seek those things that will make our life beautiful in His sight. Not the false things or the false equations of gain, where more is better and newer is better and shinier is better and other is better. That would mean constantly moving to the next level, climbing the ladder of the working world, never being satisfied, hoarding more and more, building bigger houses with bigger garages to fit in more of our stuff and pushing our own self-achievement. But no, that's not what it's about. It involves a simple reorientation of our hearts to the present. To be present, more present, and to take simple joys in a job well done. To love what we have, to worry less, seek more joy, more love, more being in the moment. Knowing that God gives joy in work, that God notices us, more than that, that He knows us. Do your work, whatever it happens to be, with joy. What Ecclesiastes does is to tell us not to buy the lie that where we sit in life has any bearing on the joy and engagement with it that God has given us. Because this would be to misunderstand God. It would be to misunderstand the world He has made and the life He has given us in it. Now, our exploration of this book today might have given you more questions than answers. And maybe that's the point of Ecclesiastes. Perhaps the point of us is for us to share our questions with God and seek his wisdom even as we are discombobulated. One of my favourite words. Even as we are discombobulated, like, what the heck? By the strange and sometimes paradoxical nature of this wisdom literature. What's my view? Life is a gift from God. It's an opportunity to participate in his world. And even work can be something that gives us an opportunity to experience and enjoy some of life's simple pleasures, leading to abiding joy. And it's my prayer that we might have God's view, God's wisdom in whatever we do. Whatever we're doing in our working or volunteering or caring or retiring lives, we might have God's wisdom. We ought to be grateful that God has given us this and use his perspective on it. Be thankful to God for your life. Be present in your life. Don't let it pass you by. Life is for the living, and that includes work. Work hard. But be mindful of storing up treasures in heaven where they are not fleeting, nor are they meaningless. It is better to want what you have than to have what you want. Life is full of uncertainties, and the teacher questions the meaning of life. Who am I? Why am I here? Where am I going? And these are questions I reckon we've all asked at some point in our seemingly meaningless lives. Who am I and how can I be me? Chapter 9 gives us a partial answer to this. It tells us what life is like and it tells us how we ought to respond. So I'm suggesting enjoy the life that God has given us because God is good. Amen.